Well, I am thrilled that you have chosen to join me for this particular half chapter. It is truly one of the most beautiful moments that we get in all of Jesus' life, and especially with regard to his interaction with his disciples, and because we are his disciples, us. So let's dive right in. As always, the Phillips translation will be in John 13, 1 through 17. Here we go. Before the festival of the Passover began, Jesus realized that the time had come for him to leave this world and return to the Father. You often hear statements like, Jesus was born to die, and Jesus' one mission was the cross. And yet, here and also in the book of Luke, we are told that Jesus himself marked time by his impending ascension, not the cross or the resurrection. Here's how Luke writes it. Now, as the days before he should be taken back into heaven were running out, he resolved to go to Jerusalem. That's Luke 9:51. It was out of his own love for the Father, with his eyes on their reunion, that he dared to approach the cross. It was out of his love for us, with his eyes on our reunion with the Father through him, that he carried through the plan of the cross. And yet it's only as the ascended heavenly high priest that Jesus can administer the gifts that are ours because of the cross and the resurrection. If he were not there right now, we would not be here right now. And then before we go on, one little gospel controversy to note here. Only John has the Last Supper with its foot washing and last discourse happening before Passover begins. The other gospels have this evening being a Seder dinner, a Passover dinner. John has the day of preparation, the day of the slaughtering of the lamb, being the next day, the day of the cross. Either way, I think we can agree, though, there is symbolism and glory afoot. Let's go on. He had loved those who were his own in this world, and he loved them to the end. Stop again. Because that's not just the end with reference to a space of time ending. The word John uses there can really mean fulfillment, completion, consummation, perfection, or that he loved his friends, the disciples, to the point of, quote, the supreme goal. Which really reframes his wondrous foot washing that's about to happen, not just as some height of his love, but as an act that was perfectly in accordance with the ongoing 3 years of love he had given to them, and that was now being fulfilled, now being completed. So looking back, how had he loved them? Well, he had chosen them, lived with them, eaten with them, taught them, corrected them, rescued them, sent them out upon his work. And again, don't forget, he had walked out every day with them. So, in other words, he loved his disciples just as he loves us. There is not one aspect of his loving them to the end that's not identical to the ways that he has loved us to this point in our lives. So, as our hearts are always stirred by this amazing moment of love and servant-heartedness, may our feet feel the touch of his tender, worn hands. Because, my friend, it is your feet he is preparing to wash. By supper time, the devil had already put the thought of betraying Jesus into the mind of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son. So right there, we are told the thought that is happening currently in Judas's head. But here's what is concurrently occurring in Jesus's heart and head. Jesus, with the full knowledge that the Father had put everything into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from the supper table, took off his outer clothes, picked up a towel, and fastened it round his waist. Which really, as I stopped to ponder on it, is such a strange and inexplicable enough action or set of actions. I imagine the disciples watching him do those things in silence, kind of wondering to themselves, maybe even exchanging side-of-the-eye glances with each other. But then this. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to dry them with the towel around his waist. For me, it's the silence of his actions that always gets me. The slow rise from the table, that taking off and hanging up of his cloak and tunic, his eyes searching around the room and then spotting a towel, picking it up, wrapping it around his waist, tying it off at the back. over by the door, he then takes up a large clay basin, fills it with water, and walks over toward maybe John. He gets down on the ground right before him, unstraps John's dusty sandals, and then in silence, lifting up John's foot with a tender hold on the back of his heel and Achilles, he starts to scrub and soak the crusted dirt and grime. Even the servants of the rich never gave such a thorough washing to the feet of the rulers. Jesus spends his time on every inch, between every toe. And when he's finished, it's on to James or Nathaniel next. My friends, can you imagine looking down at the top of Jesus' head, his hair maybe a little unkempt, as he is bending over to carefully, lovingly wash your dirty feet? In that moment, all the disciples, utterly shocked and ashamed, must have so wondered what could be the motivation for such inexplicable, really kind of disgustingly servile behavior from their master, their teacher. Well, you and I, we are told his motivation. It was the full knowledge that the Father had put everything into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God. In essence, his motivation is the midsection of Colossians 1, that Christ is the visible expression of the invisible God. He existed before creation began, for it was through him that everything was made, whether spiritual or material, seen or unseen. Through him and for him were created power and dominion, ownership and authority. In fact, every single thing was created through and for him. He is both the first principle and the upholding principle of the whole scheme of creation. And you see, it was for that reason, with all things placed in his hands by the Father, that he now stoops to wash the nasty feet of his friends. God had once chosen to walk with Adam in his perfection. But now God has chosen to wash the feet upon which walk the imperfect sons of Adam. I think this is the most intimate moment in the scriptures. This is the precise heart of the God who made it all, and us all, you. So he came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" You know, I'm consistently appreciative of all the ways that Peter's life and actions and reactions to Jesus are such great object lessons. Honestly, it's my best guess at how I probably would have followed Jesus while he was incarnate. Off the cuff, knee-jerk, and most of the time, passionately, idiotically. Over these last few minutes, watching Jesus quietly make the rounds of his friends, Peter has been preparing this little moment when Jesus should arrive before him. He's already thought through the exact posture he's going to take and the terms he's going to set for putting Jesus off of his goal. You see, Peter would have the Jesus of Peter's imagination. The actual Jesus is now doing something absolutely too extraordinary. "You do not realize now what I am doing," replied Jesus, "but later on you will understand." Then Peter said to him, "You must never wash my feet." "Well, unless you let me wash you, Peter," replied Jesus, "you cannot share my lot." "Oh, then," returned Simon Peter, "please, not just my feet, but my hands and my face as well." So, not only does Peter try to set his own terms for Jesus, both in terms of Jesus' activity and Peter's expectation of him, but now, having tried to differentiate himself with this sort of false humility, he's taking the opposite tack, excessive devotion. He will be the most well-washed of all the disciples, the most ardent, the most courageous, the most exciting, the most faithful. But you see, the only problem with all of this, the term setting, the putting Jesus in a box, the false humility, the devotional excess, is that all of it is sourced in Peter himself. In the space of maybe, I don't know, 30 seconds, Peter has shown us the way that probably most of us try to follow Jesus all the time. But from our side, there can be no terms, no box, no self-humility, no self-excitement. What Jesus is after are vessels fit for his service, washed by his own hand, and ready for him to fill with himself. Yes, he is going to make use of your personality, your gifts, your emotions, your humility, your career, your dreams, all of that, but only on His terms and in line with His way, not yours. The man who has bathed, returned Jesus, only needs to wash his feet to be clean all over. And you are clean, though not all of you. For it says, Jesus knew his betrayer, and that is why he said, though not all of you. You know, I don't think we see much of Jesus in the four Gospels being ominous, but that's ominous. When Jesus had washed their feet and put on his clothes, he sat down again and spoke to them. And apart from his words with Peter moments before, this is the first time he has said anything since this whole foot washing thing began. So imagine how the disciples are leaning in as he opens his mouth here. Do you realize what I have just done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you're quite right, for I am your teacher and your Lord. But if I, your teacher and Lord, have washed your feet, you must be ready to wash one another's feet. I have given you this as an example so that you may do as I have done. Here, both this translation, the Phillips translation, and the NIV really weaken the meaning of what Jesus has actually said in verse 15. Rather than, I have given you this as an example, or I have set you an example, Jesus actually says, I have given you a pattern that as I did to you, you also should do. A pattern. An exact model that is meant to be repeated exactly. An original which, in replication, will always stay the same and, in its replications, will always match without fail. My friends, is the foot washing our pattern, our paradigm, our sample, our standard? When we think of what it means to daily follow Jesus with regard to our lives and other people's lives, is the image of Jesus, half naked on the floor, washing grimy feet, our high watermark? Do we consistently make ourselves very small in other people's eyes? Do we consciously work to abase ourselves publicly? It strikes me there that Jesus reminded them of his position before them, teacher and Lord, before telling them to pattern their behavior after his. I think you and I are generally quite adept, actually, at making ourselves small in the eyes of people, quote, above us, like bosses and people with high social standing or people we need to get something from. But what Jesus wants is that we would make ourselves nothing, that we would so serve all people, almost especially those we consider beneath us. That was what he did during every single moment of his whole earthly life. This is God in the flesh. Don't forget it. He goes on, believe me, the servant is not greater than his master, and the messenger is not greater than the man who sent him. Once you have realized these things, you will find your happiness in doing them. This past week, as I've been preparing and thinking through this message, I have just been unable to shake an analogy that was told to me by my friend Bill, one that he saw acted out at a retreat. And it was about how the wrath of God was poured out on Jesus. And here's how he explained it. He said the speaker had a glass in his hand, and then with one quick flick of the wrist, splash, all of it was poured out. And that image, I just have not been able to get out of my mind this week. So I'm going to steal it and change it. When we watch and observe the life of Jesus of Nazareth, you have to remember that we are watching the ways, the lifestyle, and really the exact life of God, the exact heart of God, the exact nature of God. And if you have been listening along since all the way back in John chapter 2, he himself is the good wine, the one who brings flavor and joy and atmosphere to every single place he goes. So, oh, my friends, may we every day be filled to the brim with that joy, the love, the life of Jesus. May our cups be filled to overflowing with Jesus himself. And may we so believe in the goodness of that life and that way of Jesus that we fear nothing in every day being poured out to the very last drop. And then, may we also every day prove our belief in the reality of the resurrection by our expectancy that absolutely without question, he is actually alive and able to fill our cups all over again. Just as he said, Once you have realized these things, really, once you no longer settle for the dregs, your own flesh, you will find your happiness in doing them. My friends, let's be poured out. Let's be poured out every single day, right to the last drop. Let's not even let one drop linger of that life of Jesus poured into us each morning and each day throughout. May our abiding in him make us so overbrimming with his life that people cannot help but see Jesus when they see us and see us pouring it out and then even getting down there to wash their feet with that love that is so gracious, so glorious, so divine. Oh, let's be the ones who wash feet. Let's make ourselves so infinitesimally small. Ah, that's Jesus. Thanks for listening.